I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today. Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. This is the Pot of Thunder and Rock and Roll. The remedy for boredom has arrived, and it is Friday with a little bit of a different turn of events on this show today. If you listened to the Station Fire tragedy show with Mike Riccardi that we had on a couple months ago, this was recorded on the same day as that. Very, very heavy subject, especially for me because I was very close to it. Today is the 9-year anniversary of the death of Chris Benoit and the tragedy of the Benoit family, the loss of Nancy Benoit and their son, Daniel Benoit. I had done an interview with Bill Apter a few months ago, a year ago, whatever it was, where he had a certain theory on Chris's death and the whole facts and figures and the events that took place on that weekend. A little bit more of a fantastic, I think there was a conspiracy idea that he had or something on those lines. After that happened, Sandra Toffoloni contacted me. Now, Sandra is Nancy Benoit's sister. They grew up together. She was there for Nancy when she was married to Kevin Sullivan, and then throughout the whole duration of the relationship of Chris and Nancy, aunt to Daniel, nanny of the family as well. And she contacted me and said for the first time ever she wanted to do a full in-depth interview on her, I guess, her thoughts and her side and her experiences with the whole situation of what happened 9 years ago in 2007, June 24th, 2007. So she contacted me and we met up in Orlando. She lives in Florida, Southern Florida. I live over in Tampa, as you guys know. We met up in Orlando the weekend of the Royal Rumble to have this conversation. And I wanted to wait until this weekend to air the show. Very poignant and very timely. So she is going to talk for the first time ever in depth about her sister and nephew's murder and what may have caused her brother-in-law, Chris Benoit, to kill his family and then take his own life. Now, everyone knows that Chris was one of my closest friends, not so much at the time of all this, but for years, probably from 1994 to 2004 or 5, he was my number one guy, him and Eddie Guerrero. So very close to the situation and still haven't really come to complete terms with it to this day, as I'm sure many people haven't, fans and friends and family alike. But that's why it was so great to talk to Sandy and get her perspective on all this thing, because she was very close with Chris as well. And she's going to share some of her good memories about her brother-in-law, in addition to amazing heartfelt thoughts and stories about her sister and her nephew. It's funny because I read some jackasses online saying, oh, I hope this isn't going to be a whole burial of Chris Benoit, a whole bashing of Chris Benoit for an hour. Of course it's not. But it's very, this is the very true story of what happened before, during, and after. Chris was a great guy, tremendous guy. Something happened on the last weekend of his life, but it wasn't just the last weekend. It was months and months before, which Sandra is going to tell us about. She's going to speak very candidly about what it was like in the minutes, hours, days right after they found out that Nancy and Daniel had died and how they died. She's talking about staying in the house right after it happened, dealing with press and with all the fans, and how she's doing today. So it's a heavy show, but it's a one that I really felt driven to do, and I really wanted to do this, and I'm really glad I did, and I hope you guys get a little closure out of this as well. Inside look at the Benoit family tragedy with Nancy Benoit's sister, Sandra Toffoloni, and myself. And we'll get to Sandy right after we talk about another unbelievable story, but this one had a happy ending, although it could have very much ended in tragedy as well. This story will leave you feeling inspired and wanting to change your life for the better as well. Talking about the documentary, The Resurrection of Jake the Snake, which just came out on Blu-ray and DVD. I can't say enough about this documentary, not a wrestling documentary. It's just a story of one man's battle back from near death to reclaim his life, family, and career, and he just happened to be in the pro wrestling business. But even if you saw this documentary when it came out in the theaters, or if you saw it any other way, you're still going to want the collector's edition DVD of this movie because of the extras that Diamond Dallas Page and his team meticulously loaded onto this DVD. They're very, very fine-tooth comb with all the stuff they put on there. 20 bonus features, including a commentary track narrated by DDP himself, Jake the Snake, and director Steve Yu. And right now, if you go to ddpyoga.com/Jericho, you can get this must-see documentary. You can get 10% off the collector's edition Blu-ray or DVD, or anything else you order off of ddpyoga.com for a limited time. You all know what DDP Yoga has done for me. It saved my wrestling career, saved my music career, saved my quality of life, and you can see what it did for Jake the Snake when you get this documentary. Diamond Dallas Page and DDP Yoga literally saved Jake the Snake's life, so get yourself a copy at ddpyoga.com/Jericho. You will be inspired, and then give DDP Yoga and the DDP Yoga Now app a try yourself. I'm telling you, this is the real deaf. If you're becoming deaf to this because I talk about DDP Yoga every week, don't. If you're overweight, if you're having issues with your soreness, I was having some major elbow and shoulder problems over the last week after two street fights in Salt Lake City and Los Angeles, and then the Money in the Bank ladder match, which just kicked my ass when Cesaro swung me through with a giant swing into that ladder. I was protecting my head with my hand, and that hand got squished right in the ladder. Couldn't bend it for days, and the shoulder attached to it. But DDP Yoga is helping me loosen up. It's helping me to feel better. So go to ddpyoga.com/Jericho. Get 10% off anything you purchase for a limited time, including the Jake the Snake Roberts DVD and the DDP Yoga program yourself. ddpyoga.com/Jericho. Go give it a try, man. Get off your ass. It's time to do it, all right? Get a better quality of life and make it happen now. All right, you know what else I made happen? It's coming on March 15th, 2017. It's the biggest podcast ever. Jericho versus Foley. That's right. Jericho and Mick Foley together on Talk is Jericho for the first time ever. March 15th, 2017. 263 days and counting until the biggest podcast ever. Okay, so it was a couple months ago. I had Bill Apter on the show, and he was talking about his theories on the Chris Benoit tragedy. And then you reached out to me, Sandy Toffoloni, who is Nancy's sister. And I'm not even really too sure how it came about. Did you just text me? Did you have my number? Or?
I did. I did just text you. Yeah, I have everybody's number,
right,
of course,
right. Yeah.
From kind of growing up a little bit one step away from the business. So I had reached out to Paul Heyman, who I had asked about, who's Bill Apter and what is this about? And he's like, oh, you know, why don't you just talk to Chris about it? And he said, do you have his information? Mm-hmm. And I said, actually, I do. I really do. Yeah. And so I just texted you and said, hey, that's the craziest thing that I've ever heard, and I want to talk to you about it. So.
Yeah, and we'll kind of get into that. But you have mentioned this before we got on the air, talking about Paul Heyman, and you and him are seem like you're pretty good friends.
We're very close. He's been a constant source of calm, mm-hmm. surprisingly, mm-hmm. in my life since everything happened. And my sister told me many, many years ago that if there was anyone to trust in the business or anyone to talk to about things other than the business, the person to always trust is Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And I took that as gospel law when she says something like that, because she doesn't say things like that lightly.
Right.
So he was the first person in the business that I contacted after everything had happened. Mm-hmm. And when we talk on the phone, he always laughs because he said, it's like talking to your sister. You sound just like her. You laugh just like her. It's like, it's very comforting to him too.
I said too, like you have the same cheekbones and you can see a lot of similarities there. And actually the first time I ever met Nancy was at an ECW show. My first one, I think was her last one before she went to WCW. Mm-hmm. But I remember she told some jokes, just very friendly, fun person to be around. And she was your older sister.
Older sister. Right? We're exactly 10 years apart.
Okay. Oh, really? 10 years apart. Now, did you have any other brothers or sisters?
No, it's just the two of us.
Okay.
Yep.
So she was probably someone you looked up to your whole life. Yeah.
Very much so. Very much so. We're both 17s, born on the 17th. She's May and I'm October. Mm-hmm. And she and I are 10 years apart. And then our parents are also... We all turn the same age every year, you know, like when one of us turns 31, she turns 41, my mom and dad turn 61, so it's like that.
Yeah, a little bit of family,
so, kismet. Yeah, she was the biggest influence in my life, you know. She's more like a mom kind of than a sister until I got a little older, then we could kind of cause trouble together. Then it was more like a sister and a best friend.
And she was already in the wrestling business at that point, right?
She was. She's been in since she was... about 15.
15?
Yeah.
Really?
Did you not know?
I didn't know that, yeah.
Her very first, this was a long time ago, Florida Championship Wrestling days. And her first time out to the ring was with Blackjack Mulligan. And she went out there in a bathing suit with her hair all curled and whatever at almost 16. And just... at a place here in town in Orlando called Eddie Graham Sports Stadium, which is an old wrestling haunt that a lot of people will respond to. And she just fell in love with it from there. I mean, from that very moment, fell in love with it. And then ended up meeting Kevin a little while after that. So
did you grow up as a wrestling fan then as a result?
No.
Okay.
I have not, and I am so ashamed to, not ashamed to say that, but I never had any kind of affinity for the business, except that I enjoyed the people in it, meeting everyone outside of their persona and outside of work. Mm-hmm. I had some, sadly, most of them are not with us anymore, but I had some very fond memories of some wonderful people that, were around through my formative years, like my ex-brother-in-law, like Kevin Sullivan and Mark Lewin, who was the Purple Haze years and years ago. I'm showing my age, but then after that, it was Rocco and Johnny Grunge, which that was Mike Durham, you know, and Mike Durham actually was my sister and Chris's neighbor in Peachtree City for years, and my sister and Chris were godparents to his son, Mikey, and Mike and I hit it off gangbusters. We were serious troublemakers. We caused a lot of damage in Peachtree City and a lot of damage in Daytona. Whenever he disappeared, Kevin would call me and send me out around Daytona to bars and stuff to find him. So we had some good time. So I enjoyed being around the business that way. But as far as... you know, sitting through matches and stuff like that, it really wasn't.
Yeah, you enjoyed the camaraderie part of it.
I did,
which
I
is
did.
A big part of the business. Yeah.
Yep, and it's a bigger part of it than you would imagine that it is. Mm-hmm. You know, going like production meetings and stuff like that. Like I saw through Kevin and especially with Chris how, you know, the more tame side of everything, you know, the kind of snoozer side of it, like, oh my God, another meeting.
What did you think of it when Nancy kind of became a national and an international star in the business?
I still thought of her as my, you know, naggy older sister a little bit, you know, but back in the WCW days when Nitro was on and it was like she was on TV every single week, sometimes twice a week, it was... I think I was in the end of junior high going into high school. So a lot of people were like, you know, oh, can you get us wrestling tickets? Your sister's on TV. And I was like, really? People want to see her? Or, you know, I'm someone because, quote, my sister's someone. And I was like, wow. But I was just very proud of her because she, you know, stayed true to herself and was happy and content in what she was doing. And she also brought a lot of women along into the business, which... up until then, really wasn't
that is true.
A thing. She was one of the very, very first valets in the business that parlayed itself into now mm-hmm. what we know in the modern wrestling world is, you know, the Divas.
Divas, right.
Right. So, yeah, she and Liz and Luna, and they were the very first.
That's true. I mean, because, I mean, and Nancy never wrestled. She was always, like you said, a valet. Mm-hmm. You know, she was standing, you know, the ringside and being involved in that respect, which is kind of a lost art in this day and age, but to be able to do that and be a part of the show in such a big way.
Mm-hmm. And it is. And she turned that into, I guess, with her, we're both kind of big personalities. We get that a lot from our parents. Mm-hmm. But she turned that into being a manager. And when she went, you know, she started managing acts like Doom and Public Enemy and mm-hmm. things like that. She parlayed that into an actual managing career. And I think that that's important as well, because it turned into, oh, she's a beautiful girl and she's great to look at out in the ring. But, you know, her persona, obviously, through a lot of that was being mean and being evil.
Yeah.
And being, you know, that
right.
was her. She was a heel, obviously, yeah. for a very long time. And she turned that into the greatest thing ever. I mean, she really...
she was really good at it. I just really love the name. Her name was Woman. Like, it's just yep. like, Woman.
Just, that's it. That's it. And she went from Fallen Angel, and mm-hmm. then she did this stick, like this shtick in the middle there, where she dressed up as a nerd. I think it was with the Steiner Brothers.
Oh, yeah.
She dressed up as a nerd in the audience. I just want to say, for the record, that was my idea, because I'm the nerd of the family. I was like, what if you were a total geek, like, marking out in the audience, and then, you know, oh, it's really you. When you, she's like,
that's kind of how she came into WCW, right?
Right. Yeah. That is exactly. Yeah, she was Robin Green.
Oh. And then that was what how she got into the WCW world.
Right, and turned into Woman, you know, after that. So, that was, you know, that was a huge deal. Mm-hmm. So, and bringing Paul up again, he was a huge part of that.
Yeah, he was there at that point in time.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yep.
How long was Nancy married to Kevin Sullivan for?
They were together for almost a decade.
Okay.
And they were married for a shorter time than that, but they were together for almost a decade, living together and working together. So
yeah.
I think it was only about 4 or 5 years, if I'm not mistaken. So, and then it was, you know, she was head of Kevin and went right with Chris.
Mm-hmm.
He had, you know, that was a whole.
When did you start hearing about Chris from her? Did she ever mention his name at all? Or
just from working mm-hmm. a little bit. And then they had a fateful trip to Japan. And when she came home, things had, in her personal life, had turned a little differently. And she had sort of kept me out of the loop a little bit about what had happened. She didn't want me to know the details of it. Just, she didn't want me to be upset.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know about it. And right coming right out of the Japan trip was Bash at the Beach in Daytona. And that was my first actual physical meeting with Chris, ironically, mm-hmm. was backstage at Bash at the Beach. And I had been sitting with Kevin's kids in the family section of that match. And I didn't know what was going so wrong during the match. I, you know, mm-hmm. as someone who has sat in the family section through many a match, admittedly reading a book, but whatever. I was there, kind of paying attention yeah. a little bit. You know, I used to get glares from
from the fans.
From the fans. What is she doing? Yeah. But I could tell something wasn't right with the match. And then
Was it a match with Sullivan versus Benoit?
It was with Chris and Kevin. It was a retirement match.
So you could tell something wasn't going right in what way?
It was very, you know, it wasn't just what's usually choreographed and gone through. Everyone knows you can seriously get injured during wrestling.
Sure, sure,
and,
sure.
You know, the worst things can happen. And I saw Kevin sort of lose his balance after a hit from Chris to the head. And I didn't know what was going on. And he had boxed Kevin's ear. And
so they were really fighting.
They were going at it
mm-hmm.
hard. And then cameras cut off and they went back into the dressing rooms, and then Rick came out, Ric Flair had come out for just a moment and put his hand in the air and waved at myself and Kevin's daughter to get up, and we walked back there, and they were fighting in the hallway.
Wow.
Yeah. But someone was standing between them,
mm-hmm.
and Kevin said, come on, we're leaving. He motioned to me. And I started to walk toward him, and Chris stepped toward me and grabbed my arm. And he said, your sister wants you to come with me.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I don't know. I didn't know him
at
all. You know, I'm like, I'm going with my brother-in-law. What are you, crazy?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
He's like, no. He's like, I'll call her right now. And he did. He called my sister right then and there. And I got on the phone with her. She's like, I want you to leave with Chris right now. Get out of there. And that was my first introduction to Chris. Was a weird, awkward situation, but he was very calm and you know, kind to me when I was like, what is going on? Like, just freaking out about it. And then once I got home with my sister and got the whole rest of the story, I understood a little bit more. So.
It was a strange situation because the storyline that was going on TV was that Sullivan and Nancy were together, and then she turned on Sullivan and went with Chris Benoit or something along those lines. But in real life, that's kind of that led to actually really happening.
Right. It did. It led to it happening. And it's been said over and over in the business and behind the scenes and right up front, I guess, that, you know, Kevin Sullivan produced and wrote his own divorce.
Mm.
And, you know, and he's great at what he does. So it really came through. But it was so much more than that. I mean, Nancy and Chris really just fell in love, madly in love. And they were both in weird different situations when it happened. And, you know, nothing mattered, though, than them wanting to be together and start a life and a family together. So,
right, yeah, because they were both married at the time.
At the beginning, they were both married at the time. Yeah.
What was your first impressions of Chris, besides the weird...
besides the weird introduction. Yeah. He was very quiet, as we all know, and my family were Irish and Italian, so we're very loud and very, you know, we voice everything and I crack jokes almost constantly. I kind of don't know what else to do. I'm not cracking a joke, so sort of my default mode. And he's very reserved, as you know, from Edmonton, and sarcasm, one of my go-to in my bag of tricks, sarcasm doesn't translate sometimes too well. Canadians, because they're so nice, and they don't really get when you're like, you know, say something sarcastic. Oh, she's really funny. And if you say really like that, Chris would be like, oh, is she? I'm like, no, dude. Like, right, look at my face. Get the inflection.
Yeah.
And then he would laugh. Then after about 6 months of knowing each other, he just constantly laughed at everything that I said. So he was kind and considerate, very quiet, very focused, and just a driven guy.
Right.
But, you know, caring. I mean, he loved my sister. He wanted to be around myself, my parents a lot, you know, so it was kind of a stark contrast from relationships that she had in the past where, you know, as a family, we weren't too involved in a relationship. But up there, when she moved to the Atlanta area with Chris, you know, we were constantly... open door policy, come whenever you want, which, as you know, in this business is almost unheard of to just be like, yeah, come over whenever, because there's always a house show, there's always a match, a flight, a this, a that. So, you know, everyone's very busy, but with him, it was just like, show up, just be there, you know. So.
You mentioned, you know, Chris and like, oh, is she really funny? Like, he had a very weird sense of humor, but I remember, like, there's this tape that I heard in Canada. It's like a joke radio station. It's called Brock at 99. Mm-hmm. And it went around like to everywhere. Like, it's kind of an underground thing. And it's everyone that would hear it would just be laughing at how like funny it is. And I played it for him one night. We were driving somewhere and he never laughed once. And I started thinking, like, is this just not funny anymore? Like, do I have a bad sense of humor? And he's like, no, it's really funny. I'm like, you're not even laughing. He goes, oh, I'm laughing inside. You know, and it's like, it's just a weird, you know, that was him. And then, you know, somebody would, you know, puke all over themselves and he'd be laughing hysterically. Like, it was the funniest thing in the world.
Ever, yeah.
You know, that's just kind of the strangeness of that guy, you know?
Yeah, he did. It's not that straightforward, like, you know, have like an observational humor, and if I would say something or we'd be out to eat or say something and I like kick him on the table and be like, check this out, you know, and say something a little funny, and he'd be like, and he'd more examine
straight-faced,
it. He'd examine it more than be like, oh, and roll his eyes and laugh with me. And so it took me a long time to get in there. I used to always tell my sister, what is his deal? You know, what's the story? Like, I'm using my best material. I'm like, I'm dying up there. You know, is this thing on? Yeah. Kind of thing. And she's like, oh, that's just him. She's like, you'll get there. And I think it was more of just him really, of us spending more time together and getting to know one another, that it was like, oh, okay, now I see why she's funny. And then, after that, it was like floodgates open. We would crack each other up constantly in the kitchen, usually at the expense of someone else in the family, like being funny. But what was really funny is when Daniel got to the age of where he'd start mimicking, you know, he would hear Chris and I in the kitchen laughing, and he'd sit on the couch and he'd make fun of us laughing. He'd be like, "Ah, ha, ha," like in a sarcastic laugh.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that's my nephew for sure. He's making fun of us laughing. He does that all the time.
Yeah, I mean, Daniel was Chris and Nancy's son, and I mean, Nancy had never had a child with Kevin Sullivan. So how was that when she was pregnant, and was it, you must have been pretty excited?
It was the greatest thing ever.
Yeah.
It was the greatest thing ever. She was thrilled, happy. He was thrilled, happy. We all were. I mean, it's, you know, he was my only nephew and the only grandchild my parents had. So we were just very, very thrilled, very excited, and couldn't wait.
Right.
I just couldn't wait to meet him. So she had a lot of filet of fish from McDonald's. She used to call me on the phone and be like, "I'm having my third filet of fish today." I'm like, "You've got to stop that." Like, you know, that's not fish, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's cooked cardboard.
Yeah, it mortified Christopher.
Oh, he must have hated that.
Oh, God, it made him crazy. "I'll go get you fish. I'll go get you sandwich." She's like, "I don't want that, man. I want this."
We used to travel, me and Dean and Eddie and Chris, and Eddie and Chris were always looking at the back of like products, like, you know, how much fat is in it, how much sugar, how much grams of whatever. Yep. And I remember me and Dean would like do it because, well, that's what they were doing. One time we just looked each other in the face, we're like laughing, like, we don't care how much fat is in, like, you know, this bag of almonds. But that was Chris and Eddie to an extent too, but very strict on every single thing that they ate and did and training. They'd get up at 7 in the morning to train on an off day. Mm-hmm. Like, why are you getting up at 7? We have all day.
Right.
But that's just how he did things.
Very, very regimented.
Right.
And that was, he was always, I was in some of the best shape of my life when toward, in that last probably year and a half before everything happened, because I was up there, I was at their house a lot, like every few months and stuff. And when Chris was home, we would train together. He would drag me to the gym because Nancy was like, "I'm not going to have a gym in the house. Why are we," you know? But he liked to actually get up and go to a gym in Peachtree City. And he would drag me along. She's like, yep, Sandra will go with you. I'm like, I couldn't move from the day before, you know. And we would come home. He's like, "Man, your sister's a beast. Once you get her in there, she's like, she won't stop. She wants to stay longer than me." And Nancy would shake her head like, looking at him real sarcastically. He's like, "What's that face?" She goes, "And who do you think taught her how to do that?" And like, she did just since I was little, how to do reps with, you know, you can have low weight, but do reps, just do everything real slowly, and it'll make everything feel like it's 50 pounds heavier. You know, I heard all the tricks from her for over the years. So he was just very shocked and surprised by that I could do that for so long. And I cooked a lot and had my own restaurant for a while. And so every time I was there, that was my job, my go-to, was making every meal. And every once in a while, he'd walk through the kitchen and see what I was using. He'd be like, "It's clean, right? It's clean? All this is clean?" "Yes, it's clean. That's not real cheese. It's vegan. That's not oil. It's this." He's like, "Oh, okay. All right."
His big treat was cheesecake.
Oh, right? That was the wedding cake.
Oh, was it cheesecake?
Yeah.
Loved cheesecake.
We ordered cheesecake from the Cheesecake Factory for their wedding because it was on Thanksgiving Day. So there wasn't, you know, we didn't go anywhere. We had it at the house, didn't go anywhere or do anything. And but I went into the fridge like the day before and I saw this great big box and I go, "What is that?" Chris's like, "Oh, it's black tie raspberry cheesecake from the Cheesecake Factory." He's like, "I'm going to eat half of it." I was like, "He says that, but he'll barely have a piece, you know, and then be down in the gym." So
right.
I was like, that's good. So he did have a couple pieces. But
you mentioned going to the gym with him too, because I would, like, if we train together, which I just stopped doing it because I always felt like I had to keep up. Like there was no option. Mm-hmm. And I remember we had a match one time in Japan and I gave him a spin kick or something and it missed. And he sold it anyways, but it didn't look like, sometimes it just missed, but it goes by so fast. But he was so angry with that he goes, after the match, I couldn't find him anywhere. I was looking everywhere and he was like standing in the corner, like of a boiler room area. I'm like, what's up? And he's like, "Oh, I can't believe I sold that kick. And I just feel so bad." And we went 20 minutes and like had a great match. But that one moment he couldn't let go of, and then he said, "You know, I have to do squats." Like he had to purge himself. Mm-hmm. And I felt like, okay, well, I should do them with them. 500 hack squats. And I'm like, why am I doing this? Why are you doing this? But that he's like, he had to, like, you know, like I said, punish himself for mm-hmm. this mistake, mm-hmm. You know, and that was once again, like just this, I think, like you said, driven and intense.
Yeah.
Very intense guy.
Mm-hmm. Very know? Intense. There was always, no matter if it, what holiday it was or what was going on, there was always a layer underneath that even, you know, hindsight's 2020, but even looking back now, I'm not even 100% sure my sister ever permeated. There was just something underneath with him that kept him. It's funny that you say punishing himself, because it almost seemed like self-flagellation for any kind of misstep or mistake in his life, not just professionally, but personally as well. So, yeah, he was a very intense person. You know, there were a lot of light moments and levity and love along the way, but coming up to that, to the event, to things that happened, I had noticed that all of that light and levity was getting fewer and further between, you know, even with family, so.
At Alma, we know the connection between you and your therapist matters. But if you're already feeling stressed and burnt out, the idea of trying to find a therapist you really connect with can be overwhelming. That's why Alma's focused on helping you find the right therapist for you. When you browse their online directory, you can filter your search based on the qualities that are most important to you. Then you can book a free 15-minute consultation call with any therapist you're interested in seeing, so you can get a feel for whether they're the right fit before you commit to a full-length session. Alma also makes it easy for mental health care providers to navigate insurance. That's why 95% of therapists in their directory accept insurance for sessions, so you can find care that's affordable without stressing about the paperwork. You want to talk to someone, but not just anyone. Alma is there to help you find the right fit. Visit helloalma.com/therapy60 to schedule a free consultation today. That's helloalma.com/therapy60.
You mentioned earlier about the last year and a half. Did you start noticing? Because I started noticing stuff too. Mm-hmm. You know, I used to call Chris. I still do. We called him Houdini because he would just disappear. Mm-hmm. Like you never would know when he was leaving. If everyone was having some drinks at a bar or whatever,
yep.
Even in the arena, he would just like poof, he's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also call him the Loch Ness Monster because he would surface. And like call you on the phone, and if you missed that call, if he went back under even 3 seconds later, you wouldn't hear from him for like another month.
Yep.
And that started really getting more and more regular. It's like, you know, hey dude, like, you know, and I just, you could start like looking back now, you could see that there's some stuff like that going on more and more frequently.
Yes.
Did you notice that and have the experiences with that as well?
Definitely. There were way more instances of that. That's a great term, Loch Ness Monster, because mm-hmm. that's very, very true. I get a random text or a random call, and then I call my sister and be like, hey, I just heard from Chris in wherever, Minneapolis, you know, was everything okay at the match? She's like, oh, he's probably, you know, had a drink, just wants to chat mm-hmm. with you and hear something funny or something. And I'm like, well, I missed, tried to call back. You know, she's like, oh, yeah, he's gone.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, oh, okay, but what really became noticeable was a little bit more of like a sense of unsafeness and paranoia for the family. Like he just would like constantly be checking the alarm at night, constantly be checking things. And for himself, like when we would go to the gym and do things like that, he would take different ways every time.
Like different routes
yeah,
to the gym?
Yeah, different routes, the same gym, you know, all the time and around the same time every day, sometimes twice a day, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the way we would go in the morning is not the way that we would go after dinner. And, you know, we'd take the Hummer one day, but then I had a Mustang at the time. He's like, let's take the Mustang instead. And never, ever, ever before had that been. He was used to be, you know, fairly laid back about mm-hmm. stuff like that. There wasn't ever any issue like that. So when it did start happening, it was something I noticed immediately.
Mm.
Like, what is the deal with this? What is going on? And he seemed to have a little bit more short patience with things. You know, just that not having it sensibility, like it's just, you know, over certain things. Like, mm-hmm. you know, couldn't, like it going into Publix and getting food and stuff. He didn't want to do that anymore. He wanted, you know, he'd tell me what he wanted and send me, or if Nance and I were out during the day, just call and say, pick this up. It was a huge personality change, not crazy huge where everyone else would notice, but people around him a lot would notice. And I didn't really understand what was happening. And to be frank, I still kind of look back on it and like, you know, what was that? And was it a precursor to everything that happened? I don't know. You know, so
did you and Nancy ever talk about that?
We did a little bit, and she just said, you know, she chalked it up to part of the business. As you know, a lot of wrestlers have had, you know, near misses and weird things happen with kidnappings and stuff in their family. I mean, one wrestler did have his child kidnapped years and years ago.
Really?
Here in the States, yeah.
Oh,
it was a big deal a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so she had a little bit of concern about that, but not to the point of where, you know, I couldn't take him to Chuck E. Cheese or something because what if something happens?
Right.
Or, you know, there's someone following us or something. But she said she kind of chalked it up to it being about that. You know, the more after WrestleMania, Chris's, I guess, the way that he was perceived in the public and him being able to be in public went from us being able to have a halfway decent dinner with, you know, a few fans coming up to us not really being able to go anywhere.
Yeah, he's a legit celebrity.
He was a totally legit celebrity. Couldn't go to Disney World regular. We had to do the VIP store, mm-hmm. you know, and all mm-hmm. that stuff. So I think that a little bit of that after WrestleMania, everything kind of switched.
You mean WrestleMania where he won the title?
Right. And I think that it changed a little bit for him getting recognized that much and made him a little bit more self-aware of, you know, if someone wants to get to me this much, what about my children?
Right.
And, you know, I think that was a little part
once
of
again
it.
Mentioning earlier how private, quiet, and also very shy. He was a shy guy, which I think where the quietness came from.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure being out in public where people are coming up to you and, you know, wanting a piece of that, wanting a piece of you was probably hard for him.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. He was very, very kind to fans all the time. I don't think there's ever, I mean, even to this day, I don't think there's a story from a fan where he was a jerk and, you know, no, I'm eating. Because when people would come up to us, he'd be like, yeah, you know what? If I'll give you, you know, 10, 15 minutes of my time as soon as my family and I are done eating, can you just let us finish?
Mm-hmm.
And people would absolutely be respectful of that for the most part, you know, never really had an issue. But he was good on his word. After, you know, after a meal or after drinks, he would go over to the people and sit with them and talk and, you know, ask people about, you know, and what do you do for a living?
Mm-hmm.
You know, always a little curious and interested, you know, what else was there besides wrestling in the world? Because he didn't really know.
Right, you know? Right. Like, because his whole life, he told me once he'd never had a job other than wrestling. Yeah. His first and only job his whole life was a professional wrestler.
Yep.
You know?
Very much so.
Did you spend time with his other kids, with David and Megan?
Yes.
Yeah.
All the time. Every holiday.
Mm-hmm.
And summers.
Okay.
And they would come to the States, and every holiday, it wasn't a holiday without them. And I loved them just like I loved Daniel, because there was never, my sister always used to say that step is a dirty word, even way, way back when I was really little, because Kevin Sullivan had children as well from a previous marriage. So she was a stepmom twice to, you know, teenage kids or middle-aged kids. And we just never, ever called each other step. It was, you know, this is my niece and nephew. So I was very, very close to them and very, very close to David. He was of that age where he was able to respond and laugh and get a lot of my jokes and wanted to play more. And, you know, he was that age where you could go and do stuff with him.
Right. I got fun with him. Yeah.
When Daniel was just a baby, it's like, okay, he's sleeping. Now what do we do? You know, all that. So they called me, Daniel called me Auntie Zsa Zsa because it was the oddest thing that he couldn't say Sandra at first when he was little. And of all names he could come up with, he came up with Zsa Zsa on his own, which, as you know, is like, you know, a very fancy actress.
Zsa Zsa Gabor.
Right. Yeah. And my sister got the biggest kick out of that because she's like, oh man, he's got your number right from Jump Street. I'm like, what is the deal there? So he just, and then I became Auntie Zsa Zsa to him and also to the other kids. So I loved being with them, and they would be like, hey, Auntie Zsa Zsa, let's go, you know, their neighbor in Peachtree City had horses and mini horses and a whole farm next door. So we would always be over there playing with the animals and asking to feed them and, you know, doing all kinds of really cool stuff or really just a trip to Publix, going anywhere around the town, you know, that I could take them to go do something. Mm-hmm. Time well spent. I love those kids.
Now, Nancy and Chris were great parents from what I could see.
Absolutely.
You know, Chris is a great dad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was. Anytime that he could, he spent time with all of his kids as much as possible. Whenever he was home, you know, from the road, that's all he wanted to do was spend time with Nancy, spend time with Daniel. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
And my sister lived and breathed for Daniel. I mean, that's just mm-hmm. bottom line. He was never. We had a running joke that she was going to have to shop for a prom dress because he was never going to leave her side, and she was going to have to go to prom with him. Like, that's so creepy. He doesn't want to leave your side. I'm like, you're not that much fun. She's like, I am. I'm a riot. I'm like, all right, I guess. And being someone that she helped, you know, practically raise, I'm like, I guess I can attest to that. All right, yeah, you're right, pretty cool.
Yeah. Like, yeah, she's 10 years older than you, so it is almost like another mother sort of thing, I'm sure, right?
Yeah, yeah. It was an awful lot of babysitting. Until she left to go into wrestling, but even then it was funny because it was almost like having divorced parents, where my mom and dad would have me, you know, all week long, and then one or two weekends of the month Kevin and Nancy would get me, you know, and I get to go to the beach and hang out with Kevin and Nancy. And Kevin was a child. We used to throw water balloons off the balcony and stuff at the cars down in our condo parking lot, and then run inside and act like it wasn't us. And then the next day there'd just be splattered water and latex everywhere. And Kevin and I would just laugh and laugh. And I think back on those times, I think, man, he was a 40-year-old dude. Like,
yeah.
Like, he was just having a good time. And my sister just be in the kitchen laughing at us, being silly. So, but with Chris, he was the same way. When I could catch him like that to have a good time doing something, if I could make something really, really fun. And those, as you said, being shy and being quiet, those moments when they did happen were pretty priceless. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had a New Year's Eve of 2000 was a super big night for us. We stayed home. They had just gotten their house together in Peachtree City. My sister was pregnant, so she couldn't have any fun. So Chris and I decided to take her fun for ourselves. And we had an absolute blast. I mean, we stayed up all night. I think we were up till 4:30 or 5 in the morning, just laughing and playing music and talking about movies and TV and books. Mm-hmm. I'm an avid reader. I manage a bookstore. And he was just constantly asking, you know, what are you reading? What can I take with me? What have you got? Just devouring things, mm-hmm. you know. So
once again, with that intensity, mm-hmm. you know, everything he did was 1,000%.
Yep. And know. The same thing with music too. It was back in the days of CD burning, those ancient days of CD burning.
Yeah, right.
Before iPods. And he was constantly asking me to make me a CD, make me another road CD, make me another workout CD, all the time.
Would you put on the CDs?
Oh my gosh.
I know he was a big AC/DC fan and Stones fan.
Huge Stones fan. There was a lot of Metallica on there. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of, this is back in the day when Eminem first mm-hmm. started, so there was an awful lot of Marshall Mathers on that guy. And back when the Foo Fighters first came out, and I'm the world's biggest Dave Grohl fan, so there was an awful lot of Foo Fighters on all of the CDs. Pantera, you know, some really
energetic. Really, energy.
Yeah, I was actually surprisingly with what just happened with Lemmy, but I was with him the first time he heard Ace of Spades, and he made me play it 3 times. And we were in the car, we were in the Hummer together, and we just kept playing it on the way home from Atlanta over and over and over. He's like, "Man, what is this?" I'm like, "What is it?" I'm like, "Oh wow." So yeah, those times were, you know, the really great times that I like to try to remember mm-hmm. the most, you know, when I'm having one of those days. Yeah, when I'm feeling like, you know, how could this have happened and why did he do this to us? One of those days, I always, you know, to try not to live in a bitter mind and a bitter spirit, I try to remember those times and think, you know, that I don't know what happened, but I want to try to remember that as much as I possibly can.
So you know, that weekend, because like you said earlier, if you lined up 100 people against the wall that knew Chris Benoit, 100 of them would have nothing but good stuff to say about him. I like all the guys in the locker room looked up to Chris, his peers, fans, and all that sort of stuff. And so when you start hearing about this, you can't believe it, because it's not that guy, you know? What did you see and know in the events leading up to that, you know, June weekend, June 22nd, 23rd? Were you talking to Nancy? Did you get any, like, something weird going on here, or?
Well, there had been, prior to that, there were a couple, but there was at least one really high spot where he left the house and she had had a restraining order. He didn't get punched in the face, physically violent, but it was intense. And he had pushed her hard and into an island in the kitchen. And, you know, she had kind of been down that road before in her life and saw it coming and recognized the signs, was like, just not this time.
Mm-hmm.
Called the police, and he left the house, and then she called me, and I went down there, and she ended up going to an attorney and started, you know, putting paperwork together to make sure that the restraining order stuck and this and that. And it went on for about 2.5, almost 3 weeks. Mike Durham had come over to the house, and he had gone out to meet with Chris and then come back to the house and, you know, trying to smooth things over, as it were, between both of them, and then enlisted me in the effort and said, you know, I said, well, she's not going to talk to him. He's like, please, if you just talk to him on the phone, please. He just wants to talk. So I ended up talking to him on the phone, and he had convinced me. So I encouraged my sister to talk to him on the phone, and then they ended up working things out, and everything was okay. And that was about, I think it was about 2 years before everything happened. So somewhere in that, I think that a lot of it had to do with working. I think he was pushing himself an awful lot at work to get that push for that title. You know, I think that he was feeling, as a lot of wrestlers do, feeling their age. I think he was feeling his age and feeling like, you know, and you said it, he didn't have another skill.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't have something else that he could do. So it started to close in on him that what is going to happen when all this goes away, kind of feeling. And my sister was never worried about that, because she's, you know, she was managing his career, and she already had other things lined up for him.
Oh, she was his manager?
Yeah.
Oh, mm-hmm. Really?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. They had a corporation together. And she managed his career. And they already had, ironically, they already had plans for a wrestling school in Atlanta.
Wow.
And she had t-shirts made already.
Really?
So I'm like, I'm sitting on like 500.
What's it called?
Benoit Academy t-shirts.
Wow.
In storage, gray, with his image, his headbutt image on the back. And so she had logos designed. She was ready for the next move. And I don't think that he was, in his mind, physically, emotionally, I think he was just really scared. So a lot of that, I think, started boiling over into their personal life. I couldn't really 100% say with certainty, but as Paul always reminds me, you know, you're the one person with the most insight to it, because I was there for everything. And leading up to it, about a week before, Nancy and I were, I had something else going on in Florida. I was in North Carolina at the time. We had something else going on in Florida, and a death to someone close to our family. And I was going to go home to Florida. And she was like, yeah, let's just wait, you know, wait till Chris comes home and, you know, maybe use some miles if you have to go, if this person ends up passing away. And then there was another wrestling death. There were two wrestling deaths right before Nancy and Chris. And that, it really started to put a strain on everything. I think that Nancy was getting nervous that something was going to happen to him, or that he was going to get hurt. With Eddie's death, it put a ton of pressure on Chris as well. And I said a long time ago to Paul that he was in a state of perpetual bereavement. He was in a state of perpetual bereavement. It did not stop. And I think that when I said that to Paul, he's like, oh my God, that's it. I never thought, you know, he's like, you, that's it. He well, was. He was.
Let me expand upon that, because I was going to say this. You mentioned Mike Durham, and he, I know he, Johnny Grunge, he was kind of the middleman and a real calming influence, as crazy as he was. I know he was very involved. You mentioned that he, you know, helped Chris and Nancy back together. Johnny passed away.
He did.
Then a short time later, a guy called Black Cat, Victor Marr, who was one of Chris's mentors in Japan, passed away. After that, a guy called Ray Traylor, who was the big boss man, I'm sure you know all these guys, another friend of Chris. And after Ray passed away, Chris called me, and he was crying. And he said, I can't take it. I can't take any more of my friends dying. And lo and behold, a year or so later, his best friend dies. His, like I mentioned, it was Dean and Jericho, and it was Eddie and Chris. And those two guys always got along. I don't know what it was with them, but they had a connection that no one else had, in the ring, out of the ring. And at Eddie's funeral, Chris, he came up to me once in crying and was hugging me like a child hugging a mom or a dad that doesn't want to be taken away. Like just this, but just crushing, heart crushing reaction. And I agree with, I think that put him over the edge to where, you know, like you said, perpetual bereavement. That's such a good point, you know?
Mm-hmm. It was constant, and it was as much loss, whatever losses he suffered. Obviously Nancy, just being his wife, suffered along with him, but also with being in the business, she suffered.
Right. Well, yeah.
They knew all of those people as well as
they were her friends too.
Yes, very much so.
Right.
And you know, prior to that, long before that, with Liz's death.
Yeah.
And then right after Black Cat, there was another female death, and God forbid,
Sherry Martel.
It was Sherry. Yeah. When Fabulous Sherry died, that was. That was one of the last conversations I had with my sister. Was after Sherry died, she called me crying. And she just was like, it just won't end. It just won't end. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I know, you know, just trying to be that understanding sister. But I couldn't wrap my head around it, because I had lost a couple of friends. I was sort of young back then, but I'd lost a few friends. But not like what they were experiencing was just, you know, palpable pounding of grief. And it was affecting everything. And there was a lot of self-medicating going on in that house, you know, mm-hmm. both of them. And my sister's not a saint. No, I've never, ever claimed for that to be. But it was really, really next level after all of those events, especially after Eddie with mm-hmm. Chris. And I know that because I was in the house and I can say that. And it's not a secret.
Yeah.
Again, growing up in and around that business, I know for a long time of all the medication that sometimes takes for guys to get out in the ring, you know, and I get it, and I've seen it, and it's one of those sort of knowns, unspoken knowns of the business.
Right,
like, you know, we get it. But when it starts to be like, you know, you need 8 to be up, you need 3 to be down, you know, I used to tell my sister, I called it Judy Garland syndrome. I'm like, oh my God. And one of the jokes would be like, he's filming The Wizard of Oz, joking around about Chris. I'm like, he's filming The Wizard of Oz today. Yeah. Like, he's out there. And I got it. It's, you know, especially after suffering the grief and loss that I've suffered, I went down that road for like a year after it. And finally, one morning, sat up and I said, my God, I'm doing the same thing. What am I doing? So dumb, you know? Mm-hmm. And then finally, you know, worked my way out of it. I could hear my sister's voice like, God, idiot, this is what was going on. Don't be that way. And I think that it was a huge contributing factor to what happened. And it's not, you know, I can say it's just my personal opinion, but it's actual facts. I mean, the autopsy says so. I had seen it prior to that, the alcohol and the medication, not just the steroids, but everything else that had been going on. It was a huge factor. Mm. And I know that, you know, everyone talks about the concussion issue with Christopher, and I am certain that maybe played a role as well. You know, I don't really wholeheartedly take the institute's findings on his brain at 100% value either. But if it was maybe at MIT or Harvard and not some school in West Virginia or some house-paid school in West Virginia, different story. But still, the autopsy never said, you know, he has Alzheimer's, he couldn't find his way to, you know, he couldn't find his way out of a paper bag, he couldn't remember people. That wasn't Chris. You know, the things that they're saying that were linked to concussions, that wasn't Chris. It wasn't ever what I observed ever. That guy could get in and out of an airport in 8 minutes flat. And I mean any airport. You know, one he's only been in once or twice. Not to mention Atlanta. I could probably drop him off, spin him around downstairs in parking, and kick him through the door, and he'd find his way to the plane.
Yeah.
So it wasn't that. People didn't. And this is actually the first time that I've spoken about it. I've only ever given one interview in 9 years, and it wasn't really even an interview. It was just me talking to a friend that also happened to be a blogger for a wrestling magazine in Canada. And it was the first time that I had ever spoken about it. And we've never spoken to anyone, but it's upsetting because with Chris's dad and the big push for it to be, you know, concussion, this is why he did it, because the Chris Benoit we know could never have done this. They want to put it on something that, you know, this is the reason. Okay, good. We don't have to, you know, blame Chris anymore. But it was a combination of a lot of things. I think that it was, again, just a huge boulder of weight from loss and grief. I think that it was a ton of medication, altering his body chemistry, brain chemistry, alcohol, everything that was going on at that time, and possibly, yes, also a little bit of brain issue from hitting his head constantly over and over and over. Would it drive someone to murder? I don't know. These questions are out there with the NFL and these things. Now, you know, I can't say definitively, yes, that's what did it. I know there were issues in the house that he was having, again, with himself struggling inside with things that, you know, are privy to he and I and my family and my sister that I wouldn't put on blast for anyone to know. But that coupled with the facts of what I know from being there immediately after that weekend and seeing everything, it wasn't the act of someone, you know, with brain damage. It's impossible. It's impossible for that to have been the case. And I understand, being someone that is experiencing this loss still almost 9 years later, I understand the necessity to want to put it on something and say, this is why he did it, this is the reason, right here. Because the daily pain of living with not knowing why and not really knowing what happened is crippling.
Yeah.
For lack of a better term.
Right.
It's crippling. And I can understand his parents and his family wanting to be able to say, this is why he wasn't himself, because of this reason. And I don't believe he was himself, yes, but, you know, I can't put it on any one thing. It was a combination of many things, outside factors, and an inner struggle that he had been going through for quite some time after Eddie. And as you mentioned, with everyone else, with Cap, with Grunge, it just, he almost always kind of felt, had this look in his eye like, you know, it wasn't more of who's next, it was more of am I next in his eyes. So,
you know, it's interesting. I did a couple shows after it happened because I wanted to go on there and be the other side of the coin, because everyone was talking about evil wrestling and Chris Benoit was a demon, and I wanted to let people know that there was another side to this guy. And this weekend was a complete anomaly to what you would know about him, but there was a dark side to him too. But anyways, my point is, there was a psychiatrist that was on Larry King who was saying what you just said. From the evidence that we have here and the stories that we're hearing, you can't pin it on A, B, C, D. It's a combination. It's the perfect cocktail of all of these things coming to a head at the same time. But the thing for me, Sandy, is like, listen, you know, anybody that's ever been in a relationship, married, like, you can understand if in a moment of rage, you can't agree with it, but you could understand how someone could, you know, kill their wife. But it's Daniel was always to me like that. I don't understand that mm-hmm. in any way, shape, or form.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any theories?
I don't. I hear that more often than you'd ever imagine.
I'm sure, of course, you do.
You know, and people say, and it's a legitimate, absolute, true statement of opinion that, you know, yeah, you could see, because it happens all the time, sadly,
right.
in this country.
Right. That moment of rage.
Yeah.
Oh, no, what did I do?
And then it's like, oh, my God, what happened?
Yeah.
And I could have understood that, but what a lot of people didn't get to see is that is how much my sister and he loved one another.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if that is what happened on Friday night and there was a moment of rage and to be clear, it was serious rage. Like he brutalized my sister.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And a lot of, you know, and even though the police report is, you know, it's Freedom of Information Act in the country and people can kind of see some things in the police report on the internet and have, you know, but they didn't have to see what I saw. And I have to put that out there as fact. He brutalized my sister.
Oh, wow.
It wasn't just like maybe I hit her too hard and she hit her head.
Oh, wow.
He murdered her
mm-hmm.
brutally. And again, not being the Chris that I would equate with that. You know what I mean? That,
right.
Yeah, I couldn't reconcile the man I just talked to a week and a half before with what I was facing when the police released the house to me. You know what I mean? When you mean
they released the house, you went inside and
saw
the crime scene.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Not with any.
I understand. Advisor. Yeah. But yeah.
And I could not reconcile what was physically there, or what we witnessed to the person that I just spoke with a week and a half. But with Dan, it's there's not a word. I mean, I'm pretty erudite. I can usually find the vocabulary for many things, but when I try to talk about my nephew with that hindsight, it's difficult because I say that I don't understand it because, you know, you think about a murdered child, it's just like it's the worst thing ever. But when you think about that murdered child as like the one person in life that you love more than anything, because I did, and my sister did, and he did. So it's very hard for me to think of what had to be going on in his head and in the house or in his heart to do that. He knew for a fact that had anything ever happened to he or Nancy, that I would be there to take care of Daniel 100%. You know, there's no question about that.
So it's not like, okay, his mother is dead and I'm going to jail
for life. Right, he has no one. I'm just going to end this for this kid.
He,
you know, it would have been a difficult time, but he would have had a more than loving family to take care of him.
Right.
And all I can think of is that, you know, it was kind of a selfish last act to do that. He just, you know, I'm not sure. I can't put a reasoning behind it. It's very difficult because again, he did love Daniel very much. And all that I could really think is that, you know, if Daniel ever saw or found out what he had done to his mother, that would have broken that child.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that was going through his head. I don't know how far his thought process was even, you know, rendering his actions at that time. Like, I don't know, you know, he might have just been completely out of his mind.
But it happened over the course of a few days, though.
It did.
Is that, that's the story at least.
Yeah, it is exactly what happened. My sister was killed Friday evening. Between 11 and 1 a.m., and then Saturday morning, Daniel was killed. And then Chris killed himself Sunday evening. So he spent two full days in the house with Nancy and Daniel, not alive, which is just again, super out of character. Not just out of character, no, but that's, let's be honest, yeah, with them, that's weird.
Well, like, that's insane. He's lost his mind at this point.
Right, right. That's like, that's not, there's no justification for that. That is,
you're sitting in the house with your dead family that you murdered for a couple of days.
Mm-hmm. And for all reasoning and from reports that we had from the office, like when I called the office, the WB, when I spoke at the office with Jen, she's like, you know, he called, he was like trying to make a flight. Like he, and she just kept stuttering, like trying to wrap her, like, what the hell was he doing? Like, and he was trying to change his flight and get to the match. Like, would he think that no one knew that he did? It was just, you could kind of see where his logic was skipping in and out of reality.
Right.
You know, I mean, I think that his default mode, as we alluded to before, was to focus on work, focus on getting the job, and default to what he knew to do, go to the airport, go to work, wrestle, come home, take shit, you know what I mean? Just like, because but then I think that the psychotic break that he had was still very much happening. So he was having these moments of lucidity where I have to go do these things, but then he didn't even realize that he's in the throes of a complete psychotic break. That you just murdered your family. It was very, and then of course that completely took over when he became suicidal, or it could have been his plan all weekend.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't know. I can't say whether or not that was his plan all weekend. I know that in the search engine on the computer that he had researched the quickest and easiest way to break a neck.
Really?
Yeah.
And the story was that he basically put the pull-down rack around his neck and just let go of the pull-down handle on a weight stack and just let go?
With a towel, yeah. He had a towel around the...
And even that, like...
It's not out.
The strength to do that? Because I'm assuming to be able to break your neck, you'd need a whole stack of plates. Mm-hmm. To pull it down in that position, like, you're dealing with otherworldly,
superhuman strength.
Superhuman strength going on here.
Mm-hmm. That's what the police said.
Wow.
Like, there wouldn't have been, if he hadn't been who he was, it would not have killed, it would never have worked.
Yeah, right.
No one else could have pulled that.
And what a way to do it. Like, it's so tied into him. Like, he was obsessed with lifting weights, and that's what basically he killed himself by.
I've always hypothesized, sometimes with Paul, sometimes after a couple cocktails, but always, I think that he thought that the business was choking him, was killing him. I think that he thought that everything about it, that the fame that ended up coming after winning WrestleMania, I think that the devastation of losing friends in the business to, let's face it, some medical conditions that could have been avoided if they were truck drivers or bus drivers or, plumbers.
Mm-hmm.
But it is what everyone signs up for. So I've never gone hard on that issue. I know what it is, but I just thought that how strangely and grotesquely poetic that it was that he did that. That he killed himself by breaking his neck, which he had already done once in the ring. So it just, there had to be some thought process to that, which has always kind of eaten away at me a little bit. There had to be some kind of thought process to that, that he ended up going out that way after what he had done upstairs. I mean, it took time. All of what he did took time,
It's not like you're just putting a gun in your mouth and going...
Right.
Like, you actually would have to, like you said, construct an apparatus, to figure out how to do this.
Yeah. I mean, he researched it. It's just really, because obviously the police took the computer and, were involved with the detectives the whole time. I mean, it was in his search history. That's just... Also, that's something that's kind of not Chris, because he wasn't...
Right. Yeah.
He wasn't a computer guy.
No, he wasn't.
It was just all of it was just super, super weird. And then to have an odd religious aspect to it of putting my sister's Bible next to her and a Bible next to Daniel of, what did you think that was going to do for them? Or maybe did you think it was going to absolve you? Because they weren't a religious people.
Yeah.
I mean, my sister and I were raised Catholic, but... they were trying to get Daniel into private school. So they started kind of, you know, here in the States, if you want to get a kid into a private school run by a church, you have to be a church member.
Yeah.
That sort of
deal.
Yeah. So they had to show their face at a couple of services to try to get him into the school. But it wasn't, there was no kind of conversion that they, you know, all of a sudden they had found God. Chris was very interested, let's put it that way, in different, all kinds of different religious philosophy. Eastern religion, we both shared this book called The Life of Buddha and Christ, and it was a book on the parallels of Buddha and Christ, and we were both just we discussed it for hours. We were both so fascinated by it, you know, and I was like, you think that's crazy? Don't even let me throw Muhammad in there, because it's like, there's parallels between all of them. He's like, what? And so he started reading about that. Just, again, not interested, but not practicing. Let's just put it that way. So when that was the other thing that the police talked to us about, I was completely baffled by that as well.
His religious involvement, as far as I know, was basically through Eddie.
Yes.
You know, I know there was a couple times, because Eddie was very, very God-fearing and knew so much about the Bible and could quote the Bible. And because they spent so much time together, I think that always rubs off to where you're interested. You know, and we used to pray sometimes before matches. Eddie started doing that, and Chris would always be involved in that. So there was, like you said, some spiritualness there. But to drop a Bible, you know, that was felt to me once again. Who is this guy?
Right.
You know?
Not something you'd be like, oh, yeah, that's so him.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Like, you know? Yeah.
Just not that at all. And the thing with after Eddie's death as well, because my sister had spoken with Vic about it, and Vic Guerrero, and my sister spoke to Vic about it, and then she reached out to me. I had lost someone close to me in my life and gone through a tough time, and you know, went to a grief counselor who encouraged me to start a journal and write to that person. Like, I was just having trouble getting through my daily,
right,
you know, go to work, just the mundane things of life. When you're so grief stricken, you're like, oh, what does it all mean? What am I doing this for? That depression of asking the big questions, my sister always put it, you know? And so I said, well, you know, when I went after Jim died, this helped me. And I started this journal, and it was more like a diary, but instead of saying, dear diary, I just wrote to Jim every day in my journal. And she's like, God, that's a great idea. Okay, I'm going to go hang up. I'm going to go get him a journal. And she went right out that same day and brought home like three beautiful journals for him to pick from. And she's like, you know, San had this idea, and that helped her. And she's like, you know, if you want to do it, you can. If you don't want to, you don't have to. And he sure did. He picked that journal up immediately and started writing to Eddie. And then stopped, like, about 3 months before everything started happening. So it's very weird and timing. And the things in the journal were, you know, it's mundane stuff, like, you know, here's what, you know, I had this and this and this to eat today, or, oh, I did legs today, and it was this and this, or, oh, we're back in Kansas City, or it was just...
Stream of consciousness stuff,
you know, stuff he would talk to Eddie about, you know, text on the phone, or that he would be there to share with him. It kind of seemed like it was helping until all of a sudden everything else started pounding away with Mike dying, and as you said, it's just like four or five great big giant things in a row. Sort of put him back in that headspace. Again, I think.
Yeah, that's the hardest thing about this whole situation is we just don't know. You know, we don't know, and we never will know.
Yeah.
You know, like I was even saying, like this. I mean, it could be freaking demonic possession for all we know. There's no answer.
Right.
You know what I mean?
I definitely know that it wasn't an outside source. Let's just let the internet calm down.
Yeah.
It wasn't. There, you know, my ex-brother-in-law was certainly not involved.
Right.
In fact, he just gave an interview a few weeks ago that was very kind toward my sister and my family. He was in my life for a decade, just like Chris was. So, and he put out there that, yes, I can't have children either. And so it is the only grandchild that my mom and dad will have. And he said in the interview how heartbroken that he is for them. And for me. And that was nice of him to say. You know, he's got his own life and his own deals going on. But it was nice for him to sort of reach out a little bit through the media that way. Right. But it's been a difficult road trying to come back from it. And every single day, there's not a day that goes by that I don't think of Chris's kids as well, which is something that you and I have mm-hmm. talked about personally. And I hadn't been in touch with them for over, 8 years until I just recently got back in touch with David. And it was a big deal for me.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a big deal
for him too. Yeah.
I think that it was. I mean, there were some tears on the phone and his one question to me that really broke me apart was, why did you wait 8 years?
Mm.
And my heart sank, and I was like, I tried, and I did try to reach out to him several times, and it was thwarted by other family members. And so I just sort of, I hate to say it, but I kind of gave up and thought, well, maybe it's too much for him. Because
mm-hmm.
a lot of times and a lot of days, it's too much for me as well. You don't want to be...
Yeah.
You don't want to be David Benoit.
Yeah.
You don't want to be Nancy's sister, for a moment, because you don't want to have to deal with it and think about it. So I can understand. But I'm so grateful. I'm very, very happy that we're back in touch and communicating, because, he'll always be my nephew.
Yeah. You guys are both, and Megan too, all three of you lost such a huge part of your life. You're all you have left in a lot of ways from that life.
Mm-hmm. Very much so.
How was it for you? I know for me too, and I'm a little bit more thick skinned about it, but just the whole media deluge afterwards. Of course, it was like, the irony of it once again, talking about not only how he killed himself, but the fact that the one thing he loved, he almost destroyed the whole wrestling business.
Yeah, I did.
Like, the WWE almost went down. It was that close.
I know.
And just because of all the attention on this horrible crime, I mean, you were stuck right in the middle of this.
I had to drive with a pillowcase on my head to go to Publix.
Really?
The police released the house to us, and we couldn't leave. It's not a secret because it was plastered all over the news, but we had a front gate. And I say we because in the 6 months, 6 to 8 months leading up to this, there was talk between Chris, Nancy, and I about building a second sort of a in-law house.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was 8 acres. And Chris was like, do you think that you could garden? And I was like, I don't know, dude. I'll give it a shot. Like, what's the deal with that? He's like, let's get some books. You want to go to the bookstore? I'm like, you want me to get some books? He's like, yeah. I'm like, on gardening. He's like, yep. I'm like, all right. What are we making?
Yeah.
Like, something for profit? What's the deal? He's like, no. Like, herbs and vegetables and stuff, to cook clean. I was like, oh, yeah, okay, I get it. He's like, yeah, because, if we have another kid, then Nancy's going to need the help. So this was the plan less than 6 months before all this happened, was they were planning on having another child. And, with her trying to run things, the business side of things, and having two kids and a household to run, he was enlisting my help.
Mm-hmm,
to be like,
mm-hmm.
hey, want to drop everything and come sort of be a cook slash nanny?
Yeah, work as a nanny, yeah.
Workout buddy. And yeah. I was like, come on, spend every day with my cool as heck sister and my awesome nephew. Yeah, man, that's a no-brainer. So it had just started to be like that. But, when they released the house to us afterward, there's about a half an acre from the gate to the front house, and it was just inundated with news crews. Just absolutely inundated. In fact, I crawled through a small hole in her neighbor's fence, Holly. She's the one that actually found them, mm-hmm. as well documented in the news. And we had stayed at her house the day before. It was another 24 hours before the police released the house to us, so we were staying next door. And I kind of snuck through the back and came on and then went running into the side door so cameras couldn't catch me, and then have my open the gate so my mom and dad could drive in.
Oh.
It was just, we had no idea how bad it was going to get. And what was reported, we were told by everyone that we knew and that loved us just not to turn a TV on. Just keep things quiet, don't turn anything on, don't do this, that. So we did. We just sort of sat in the house for about a good long while, just sort of staring at each other because we didn't know what to do. And then all of a sudden, my mom's like, well, let's do some laundry.
Hmm.
Let's do the dishes, because all of the dishes were still in the sink from, they had barbecue on Friday, because Daniel Daniel had just finished his horse riding lessons next door, and it ended with a little like carriage ride around the circle mm-hmm. where they lived. And so they had kind of a celebratory, you know, barbecue mm-hmm. out back for him finishing his first horse training summer. And so all those dishes were still sitting in the sink, and like, you know, there was just household stuff to be done. And my mom was just like, you know, your sister would be pissed that her house is a mess. And I was like, okay. And we just sort of started doing things like that. But I couldn't go upstairs to the office because there was blood all over the floor. And I couldn't go downstairs into the finished basement where my mom and dad's apartment was. There was a second kitchen and a whole area where my mom and dad stayed. But the gym was off to the right, and the doors were open, and there was police tape on it. So I couldn't really go down there because that was terrible. And then couldn't go up to the third floor to the kids' suite where my room was, because I slept next to Daniel. His room was next to mine. And so I just, like, emotionally couldn't do it. So for 3 days straight, we stayed on the couches. And like, just really, you know, put pillows out there. Like, what am I going to do?
Right.
Just totally in a state of shock anyways, like, regardless.
Yeah.
We couldn't turn lights on or TVs on at night, because as soon as a light would go on, the floodlights from CNN would hit the house and light the house up. Because they would think, oh, if we can get a shot of the family walking around in there.
It's the most morbid
garbage craziness. And
I had People magazine show up to my gate.
Right?
And like, why are you even here? Like, go away. F
and
off.
How?
Right. Oh, I'm just from Miami. Drove up. Get the hell out of here.
I know.
It's, you know,
the worst. And even more so was... it was difficult because there were fans at the gate, too.
Right.
And so, you know, then they're interviewing fans, which we know aren't the super most sometimes reliable sources of information. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
Although, you know, I love my sister's fans and Chris's, I understand. But come on, you know, they don't know what the hell's going on in that house, and they don't know anything about it. Even the district attorney, Scott Ballard, he had to retract a statement that, I mean, I really lost my mind about when they said that my nephew was sick.
I had like Fragile X syndrome or something along those lines,
I completely lost my mind. I went to his pediatrician's office. I got his medical records. And I was like, you're going to have to go publicly on television and apologize. You don't know what the hell you're talking about. They said there were track marks on my nephew's arm, which is preposterous. It was nothing of the sort, not in the Emmy report, not ever. And on top of that, anyone who's even remotely acquainted with the bodybuilding or wrestling or any kind of sports now in general, Major League Baseball, knows that you don't put steroids in someone IV. It's an IM situation. Mm. Everybody knows that.
Right, anyone who would think knows that.
So there was a speculation that, like, you know, he's got track marks. Was he giving his son steroids? Just this madness on television where I just was losing my mind. For the 20 minutes that I did end up turning around and watching it, I was like, boy, that was a mistake.
So many.
That was a mistake. Yeah. You know, like, I really couldn't believe it. And I really, interestingly enough, besides that and the Fragile X things, which it is absolute garbage, not even close to true, Daniel was exactly like Christopher. He had his exact, not exact, because he had this wild streak of Nance in him, too, where he'd just be crazy, funny, maniac style. But for the most part, he was a shy kid. He did not talk to you unless he knew you. He didn't want anything to do with you.
Right, you know,
he just was not like that, and that's how Chris was. And people took that for him
being slow or something,
and that was not the case. He was so smart. I mean, ridiculously smart. Chris was too. That's just my sister. It's just preposterous. Had something like that been wrong with him, had he had whatever Fragile X is or any form of been on the autism spectrum, had Downs, or had, you know, any kind of issue, not only would they have addressed it and gotten him the best of care of anything, but Chris would have come out as an advocate for any of it. He would never have been ashamed of something like that. Neither would my sister, neither would my family. So it just was, you know, again, one of those post tragedy
Yeah, everyone's looking for an answer once again, whatever it could be, you know?
And growing up in this business also, everybody's looking for an angle.
Yeah.
Everybody wants their 10 minutes on King.
Oh my gosh, did you ever see that? All these idiots coming out of the woodwork.
It was just, you know.
My goodness.
It was.
That's why I went and finally did it, because I was sick of seeing all these no-names that didn't even know Chris going on screen and being the experts. It's like, who the hell are you?
Yeah, it was 60-year-old wrestler haven for a while.
Yeah.
Like, you know, just he hasn't been around for...
Yeah, like, do you even know him?
No, not at all.
You know, and you said something else, too, that I think gets lost in all this, because it's all Benoit, but you mentioned, you know, my sister's fans. You know, Nancy was a very respected... You know, she wasn't in the business anymore, but in her time for 10, 15 years, she was 20 years, mm-hmm. especially 10, 15 of those on the national, she was a big star.
Huge.
You know, and you forget about the fact that you know, Nancy Benoit Sullivan, woman, fallen angel, whatever she was, Robin Green, was murdered too. You forget, and that always bugged me.
So glad you said that. It's been the bane of my existence for the past, you know, again, almost 9 years this June, is I can't stand that my sister's mention is an afterthought
right.
in everything. And yes, it's awful and horrible that my 7-year-old nephew lost his life. Yes. Are you kidding me?
Yes.
It's something that is the worst thing people can think of. But my sister was a huge contributor to the wrestling business for decades.
Mm-hmm.
For decades. And didn't hurt people. She, you know, like you said, she was always funny, cracking jokes, and she was the mom of the dressing room.
Friendly to everybody. From day one, she was always nice to me. I was a nobody.
Yeah, you know? She just, you know, constantly sewing tights and doing makeup and popping on Liz's eyelashes when they constantly fell up. And, you know, and she would bring, because Liz didn't drink, so when the shtick with Rick and Liz and she and WCW, when they would come out on his arms and whatever, and they would do the champagne, she would always have like apple cider for Liz, so she wouldn't have to drink the champagne. I mean, she was just thoughtful. She thought about everyone else before herself always. And
she did a great Jim Barnett impersonation. She's a famous character. My boy. Hello, my boy. That's the first time I ever heard who Jim Barnett was, because she would talk about that. Try the swordfish. You know?
She really did.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, another wrestling legend, a Florida wrestling legend, Gordon Solie,
mm-hmm.
was just enamored with her. And it was almost like the creepiest thing, because he was really in love with her. And it was adorable, but it was also just like,
a bit creepy.
So weird. She would like make these eyes on him, like, you know, but she would play and she would make him so uncomfortable when they would shoot promos. She would make him so uncomfortable, it made him crazy, you know. And Sir Oliver Humperdinck, one of her very best friends, one of my very best friends in the business, he's sadly passed away also 2 years ago. He loved it. He would egg her on so much when they were cutting promos, like, oh, make him sound good, make him stutter. You know, he worked it with her.
Yeah.
And those were the days of wrestling that I, even as a, because I was so young, but even as a kid, I look back on it and I'm like, man, that was a good time.
Mm-hmm.
Those were the good times. You know, yeah, it might have been everybody piling into vans and driving across Florida and this and that, but, you know, God, it was a good time.
Yeah.
And it's become, you know, everything that it is now, and it's great and reaches so many people, and that's wonderful, but it's cost an awful lot.
Mm-hmm. It sure has.
It has cost an awful lot.
That's a great statement, you know, mm-hmm. to the point where the whole concept of the business, as far as the testing involved and... they're so gun shy about, and in a good way. I admit gun shy might not be the right word, but hitting guys in the head with chairs, that all stems from Chris and Eddie.
Mm-hmm.
And Eddie is still very much given legendary status in the company, and Chris has been eliminated mm-hmm. from the books forever.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and it's one of those things where it's obviously understandable for me. I don't want to see. I don't want to be watching USA and see him cut to a promo of Raw that's got like a classic match of Chris Benoit. That would break me probably. But there is a small part of me, because again, hearing my sister's voice in my head, she was just a very big believer in forgiveness and not holding on to stuff that, you know, was going to turn you into a terrible person or hurt you in your life. And I think that I've dealt with my feelings, my very complicated feelings for Chris, with her in mind. And that, you know, do I think that it's the right thing for them to never, ever mention him again? I don't know. I don't know that I'm there yet, if that makes
sense. It's hard.
I don't know that I'm ever going to be there.
Yeah.
But I know a lot of people expect me to be, he's a murderer, he's the worst person on earth, which I know is, in the one interview that I had done before, shocked Dina, the blogger from the wrestling site in Canada. She's just like, I never expected you to be so, you know, almost warm.
Yeah.
Toward him. And it's hard to turn that off. It's hard to turn off the love and affection that you had for someone who's the father of your nephew,
yeah.
who's, you know, your sister. It's very difficult to turn that off and just go straight to, he's a murdering, you know, bleep, and I can't stand him. It just, it doesn't work that way. That's why it is very complicated. But he lived for his job, his profession, and his I mean, it was his art form.
He was one of the best ever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're talking about, he has art form. Like, some of my best matches I can't put on DVDs. I can't include in any of my, you know, retrospective career, you know, bios in the WWE because they don't exist anymore.
Yeah.
You know?
And I always take that into account as well. And, you know, it's good to talk about that because it should be known that my family has never been the one to say, you know, we've never gone to court or gone to say to the office and like, never again, or we're gonna sue you, or we're gonna do whatever for, you know, just whatever pain and suffering. Never ever have I said that. None of us have. Not, it's just me and my parents, but we've never done that. Never said that. It was a decision, you know, by corporate. Do I think it's the right decision at this time? Yes,
I agree.
Yes. I don't think anyone's ready for that. I don't think, I know that every time Hall of Fame comes around, there's always a big push on the internet. Chris Benoit should be inducted in the Hall of Fame. That's just not going to happen.
How could you ever do that?
That's never going to happen.
How could you ever do
that?
They got to
let that go.
Yeah.
That's just not ever going to happen. Should he be erased, you know, because the internet exists, he's never going to be erased from anything, you know, so that's out there. But as far as, you know, an induction or anything like that, or, you know, they've already started letting his matches come back a little bit on the network. And I've seen that as well. But again, it's interesting that they would do that. But where are all of my sister's rad appearances and matches? Where's her reel? Because let me tell you what, one of the greatest matches to ever take place was a strap match with Jackie in San Francisco. My sister and Jackie. And Jackie would tell you the same thing. They went at it. They put each other over so hard. It's one of the best things I've ever seen. And not being a fan, so for me to say that, it was an incredible match. And it's hard to find, you know, and stuff like that. It kind of stinks because it is so much more difficult to find, you know, my sister stuff than is for Chris, but she never worked for Vince, never worked for the WWE. So, you know, there's a little bit more of digging involved, but, you know, I have to get with Paul and get him on that to put some stuff together for us.
final question. What do you miss most about Daniel and Nancy?
Everything seems such a stock answer, but Nancy would put Daniel, what I miss most about my sister is Nancy would put Daniel to sleep, and then it would just be the two of us, you know, Chris would be out on the road somewhere or whatever, and we'd be hanging out with Law and Order on the TV, you know, low, something non-watchable, you know, just in the background, and we would just start talking about anything. There's no subject off limits, no anything, and she just always had the best advice and insights on things, and I'm being 10 years apart, I always kind of took it with a grain of salt because I'm like, oh God, here she goes again. Doesn't she just know everything? Hasn't she just been everywhere? Yeah, she has, you know, and she instilled in me this cautious optimism, you know, of think that everyone wants to be your friend and think everyone wants to be nice to you, but always have one eye on the door. Always, always, always be ready just in case, but have fun and enjoy life, but be ready just in case. And I've always kind of taken that the same way, and it's been great advice, especially,
with everything that's happened, when you just, you know, you kind of just want to live your life quietly in the little town that I live in, where people don't know, you know,
the story,
just go to work. Yeah, people don't know who you are or what it is, but it's really good advice because you don't know who's genuine. You know, thankfully, knowing you coming into it, knowing how much Chris loved you, knowing how Nancy always spoke so highly of you, and just being, especially with David, just a down-to-earth, wonderful person that you know that you can talk with about something like this on a, you know, a normal level. It wasn't something that I had to kind of be concerned about. It's other people that are like, you know, hey, I want to interview you and talk to you about this, or I want to do this for you. It's, there's always an ulterior motive with stuff like that. And so that's, I miss those talks with her and going to her for advice on, like, literally from what shoe to wear to who to marry, you know, like just the whole gamut. Yeah. And with Dan, that's super easy. I miss his laugh. I was one of the few people that could really get him going. And when I did get him going, he wouldn't stop. And and whenever he was done laughing, he did it in this. That's why I always knew he, sadly, not surprisingly, he would have made a great wrestler because he would have had Chris's skill and Nancy's mic skills.
All right. The perfect combination.
Yeah. I mean, because he would put it over, he'd laugh, and then at the end he'd go, oh, Auntie Zsa-Zsa, you're hilarious. Like, like he was just putting me over. When I'm like, wait a minute, were you really laughing or what were you? I'm like, and then I tickle him more and be like, come on, dude, what was the deal there? And he goes, oh, Auntie Zsa-Zsa. And I'm like, man, he's just picking up everything. He gets everything. So that's what I miss. Yeah. I miss the laughs and the hugs. And with him, you know, he would have been a teenager. That's my sweet spot with kids is when they're a teenager, because, like, you know, I'm just enough of a rebel to where I'd help them get in a little trouble, but not enough to where I'd have to call a bail bondsman and have my sister, you know, slap me in the face. So it's my sweet spot of being with kids, and I, that's the only thing I'm really angry about. If anyone could say, you know, having everything taken and stolen from you, what's the one thing that you're so mad about? And that's what I'm mad about, is that I don't get to have that. I don't get to see what kind of an amazing person that he would have been.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Sandy.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much to Sandy Toffoloni for sharing all of the great memories about her sister Nancy and her nephew Daniel. It's such a heavy show. I mean, hard to listen to that and not have a tear in your eye, but I feel a little bit of closure, and I really thank Sandy for offering her thoughts on the senseless tragedy that struck her family. And we'll never really know why Chris Benoit murdered his family, killed himself. I'd have to say the only bit of closure that I've gotten over the years about this, especially after talking to Christopher Nowinski here on Talk is Jericho about concussions, I really think, I mean, it's pretty obvious that Chris was suffering from that CTE side effects that you heard about Junior Seau getting. We talked about that, and just all the football players who killed themselves, and just all these horrible things that were happening to them because of the tremendous head trauma that they suffered over the years of wrestling. No good things came as a result of Chris doing what he did. If there's anything, it's the fact that WWE now has very stringent concussion testings, and if you have a concussion, you will not be performing in the ring. I know that even Christian never worked again after getting the concussions that he received, and that's for the best, because left to our own devices, he'd probably still be wrestling. We are trying to stop this from ever happening again. It's a very physical business that we're in, but it's very easy to watch the head shots and watch the head trauma. Look at shots to the head of the chair. Those don't exist anymore. As a matter of fact, when we were having the ladder match the other day, when I threw, actually I didn't throw Cesaro into the spike, but we had that ladder sticking out like a bridge from the turnbuckle, like a spike, and Cesaro was thrown into it by Del Rio. As soon as that happened, we got told, do not do that again. No more headshots with the ladders. So very, very cognizant and very careful to make sure that what happened with Chris never happens again. But still, no real idea. We'll never know. We'll never know what happened. And it's just a horrible tragedy. And I miss them every day. I miss Chris Benoit every day of my life, I got to be honest with you. But I'm glad I got a chance to talk to Sandy. Shout out to David Benoit up in Edmonton, Canada. Great guy, getting his life together after the huge loss that he suffered. So hopefully this gave you guys all a little bit of closure in this horrible subject. Chris Benoit, one of the greatest performers of all time, one of my all-time favorite opponents, no doubt about that, and also one of the biggest tragedies in the wrestling business, history of the business. So I'm not going to say any more. Send out your prayers to the Benoit family, to Sandra, to her family, and to anybody else that may be suffering this. If you are suffering some of these effects that you heard Chris was suffering, maybe you're hearing voices in your head, or maybe you're depressed, or maybe you have some sort of issues going on with your family, please go get checked out. Things have changed in the last 9 years since this happened. There's a lot more research that have taken place, a lot more knowledge, as Chris Nowinski said, a lot more of I don't know if you ever be cured for it, but a way to treat these horrible head traumas that you may have had in the past. So watch your head if you're playing sports. If you're in junior high school or high school playing football, please beware. If you hit your head, it is not a wimpy thing to do or a bad thing to do to take a knee and sit out for a bit and go get checked out by a doctor. I can't emphasize that enough. So thanks to all you guys for listening, and thanks for supporting this podcast, and of course all the great sponsors that that have given their time to help us here on Talk Is Jericho. Of course that includes Amazon, the OG advertiser here on Talk Is Jericho, sponsor on Talk Is Jericho. To get on Amazon, just go to thepodcastone.com, click on the Killer Deals button in the top right corner of the page, and hit the Talk Is Jericho button. All my Amazon links are there. You can buy whatever you want on Amazon if you're in the USA, the UK, or Canada. And remember, every time you use those Talk Is Jericho links, Amazon links, Amazon kicks back a small percentage to this show to help us cover production costs. No hidden fees or extra charges. And if you buy something on Amazon via Amazon, become a Talk Is Jericho Amazon warrior. Take a picture of what you bought, post it on the Twitter at Talk Is Jericho. I will retweet it and I will follow you. Okay. Once again, go to podcastone.com, click on the Killer Deals button in the top right corner of the page, then hit the Talk Is Jericho button. All my great sponsors are there. DDP Yoga and the DDP Yoga Now app. Go there, ddpyoga.com/Jericho. You get 3 free months of the DDP Yoga Now app. It's an amazing piece of technology. I do all my DDP Yoga on there as well. Got rid of those DVDs and DVD player. And don't forget to try DDP Yoga and the Resurrection of Jake the Snake, the great documentary. Watch that as well. And check out True Car, the fastest, easiest, cheapest way to buy a new car. And of course, if you don't already subscribe to this fine show, get your ass over to iTunes, hit that subscribe button, and go ahead, leave a comment and a 5-star rating while you're there. We love the feedback. I read all the comments, and we are moving up the iTunes charts. It's very important. People look at that and decide whether or not they want to have their clients on this show. So give me a chance, man. Just go up there and do it. And thank you so much for listening today. Keep listening for the 60-second AP News headlines coming up next. I appreciate it. It's been a heavy, heavy show today, but we're going to get it back into the groove next week. I have got England's number one podcaster. All right. He's like the Adam Carolla of England. He's a great guy. He's a beat poet. He's a rapper. He's an actor. He's a comedian. He is the biggest podcaster in England. He's called Scroobius Pip. How could you not love a name like that? Scroobius Pip will be here next Wednesday to talk about everything. To talk about, he's a great, great, great guy and a very cool, charismatic guest. I did his show, and as soon as I did it, I said, I need him on my show. Scroobius Pip, all the way from London, England, will be here next Wednesday on Talk Is Jericho. We'll see you then. God bless you. Be safe. Please, please be safe, guys. I love you.
You can download new episodes of Talk Is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at PodcastOne.com. That's PodcastOne.com.